There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the Lantern Recycling Podcast with Benji Nyson. If you're watching on YouTube, this is just a Tour de Suisse recap of Stage 6. On podcast players, we've also got the Tour of Slovenia Stage 3 recap. But Tour de Suisse first. Why this is 8 stages, I'll never know. It's kind of insufferable torture right now. Just make it 5 or 6. Come on, Tour de Suisse. Just 5 or 6. You don't need 8. You don't need 2 TTs. Take yourself down a notch, all right? We just had the Dauphiné where the second-tier GC contenders for the Tour de France warmed up. You've probably got Alaphilippe deluding himself that he's going for TDF glory as a fourth-tier contender. Anyway, my gripes aside, this stage was 130 kilometers long. Starts with a 8.7K climb, 8.3K climb at 7%, then a long descent and valley section, and then it's like a parabola, and then they do probably the longest climb of the race, so Luc Manier pass, 18.2Ks at 5.6% descent, and then a sort of false flat, but a bit steeper than that, 7Ks, 3.5% drag to the finish in Disentis Cedrun. So before coverage started, Benji, there was absolute mayhem. We're looking at the live trackers on PCS or the race website, Twitter. What the hell was going on?
Yeah, we saw an early move by one of the GC riders, Julien Alaphilippe. And, he lost 20 seconds yesterday from the bottle incident. But he seemed to be very fired up to get started and rampage on the moment that the race started on the San Gotardo climb, because he went in the break, was together with teammate Cataneo there. And it took a while before the actual group that they were in was completed, and it ended up being a four-man group in the descent portion of the San Gotardo. They kept that up for quite a while, and the gap was pretty decent. I think it was above 2 minutes at a certain point, and then it went down and went down and it went down. And the moment that Alaphilippe got caught, everything started happening. This was at the foot of the is it Luc Manier's pass, the second yeah. climb in the race. Everything happened there, because attacks were flying left and right. And it's a bit unfortunate, because we didn't see the attack of Alaphilippe properly on camera at all, which is just a bit funny. But
well, no one knows why he dropped back. I mean, he's in a group with Cataneo, de Klerk, Van Sevenot. Well, apparently he sat up. Oh, maybe he had a mechanical. Oh. It makes no sense. I was very confused by it. No one really knows what happened, because there wasn't any commentary on the GCN feed that I was also watching via VPN, because the rights distribution for this race is an absolute shambles as well. But anyway, Alaphilippe doing Alaphilippe things. Who was the first to attack? It was De La Cruz, Benji? Or no, it was Kroon, actually, from the base, attacked in Søren Krogh.
Yeah, indeed. They started attacking very early, and that was because just after that, a large group formed at the front of the race, like 29 people in total. And I think they tried to get away from that group as well on the climb itself. They tried to push pedals, because a rider like Søren Krogh Andersen needs to try and force it on a steady wattage instead of an acceleration at the end, because he's better at that first aspect. I think Krohn could probably do both of them a bit. We've seen him do both already in his racing so far. And just behind the 29-man group, there was the peloton paced by Ineos at a very moderate pace. The gap went up to 3 minutes from that breakaway to the peloton. No one super dangerous except for like Antoine Tolhoek in there as well, who was on, I think, 2 minutes or 3 minutes in GC before the stage started. So could play a role if they let the gap go out even further, but that eventually didn't come into play. Fun fact, I was actually listening to this in Japanese, because next to VPN issues, there was also some translation issue, because there was no English commentary on GCN for the first portion of this race. So that was an interesting experience, because I don't know Japanese at all. So I didn't hear what was happening from the commentary, so I had to like focus on the race itself. A lot of attacks. Søren Krogh Andersen tried again later to open up things. And Matthews was also trying to get in second or third position there, and eventually then got dropped when we saw more moves by Søren Krogh Andersen. But what was the first like decisive attack in the front group, you'd say?
I think that the big sort of group that went into the base of the last sort of, I'm going to call it a climb, was Fabro, Tollhook, Paulus, and it was Fred Wright. And it was saying on the tick, there was also ticker issues with their transponders. It was saying it was Pernsteiner. I was looking at the guy, I was like, that guy's 6'2". That is not Van Pernsteiner. It was Fred Wright, the British lead out man for Bahrain Victorious, who isn't actually, I thought it'd be a Slovenia leading out for Bauhaus, which is what he's done for great success this year. But he was in the break. Anyway, he was in that group sitting on. Paulus was working a fair bit. I think the main attacks on that last climb were Costa, as well as, who is his UAE? De La Cruz. They were catching De La Cruz as well, but he was pretty much cooked, and Pernsteiner. So Pernsteiner caught back up to them, and then he had a group with Pernsteiner, Costa, and De La Cruz. And I don't know if Hirschi was in the group as well, Benji. I can always see Hirschi in the group as well, but Pernsteiner was doing most of the work. He can't win from the finish, from the sprint, but he gets caught up with by Andreas Krohn, the man who originally attacked. And so we have a group of Pernsteiner, Krohn, and Rui Costa. And behind, you've got riders like Paulus, Hugo Uhl, Latour, Serrano, Fabro, Tolhuk, and Leknussund. So some pretty good climbers, guys we might see, like Paulus, I think, is going to, well, there's no race on his program. He was at stage hunting at the Tour de France last year, nearly won a couple of stages. But, yeah, group with Krohn and Costa, way quicker than Pernsteiner. So what are you going to do if you're Pernsteiner there, Benji? Because really, this final climb doesn't offer you too much, particularly the last K is pretty much flat.
Well, he's pretty fucked, isn't it? Like, I don't even know what he can do. There's nothing he can do. He can't attack really because they're going to counter him. You know that. And if he attacks, then he probably won't have the acceleration to stay away because he's not exactly the most accelerative rider. So you're basically just the rider that is going to do the lead out today. And you've said to yourself with 5K to go, I ain't winning this. I might as well do these other two a favor and let them figure it out themselves.
Yeah, he tried a couple of times to his credit, but he's a small guy, he's a pure climber, and this finish just wasn't steep enough for him. Costa is one GC at Tour de Suisse multiple times. Andreas Krohn, you might remember from the first stage in the Tour of Catalunya, Volta Catalunya at the start of this year. Remember that stage in the break with Kemna, Sanchez, and Remy Rojas? He won in a sort of upset at the time, his first win, I think even it might have been his first World Tour race, he beat them in a sprint in a reduced group. So he's quite quick, not to be underestimated. For all I know, you all listening remember that. But maybe Rui Costa didn't, because he leads out on a pretty, you know, drag, and drafting is very important on this finish. It's not steep. He leads out Andreas Krohn on the right-hand side. As usual, we've got a slightly right-hand bending, and then it straightens up for the last 125 meters. Costa on the right barrier jumps early. Krohn slips into his wheel. Costa knows he's in his wheel. Pernsteiner's gone. Costa then swings, big swing from the right barrier almost all the way to the left-hand barrier. And it wasn't in a fluid movement either. Krohn's in his wheel trying to come out of his wheel to the left-hand side. And he starts to close it like Demar did to Sagan a bit last year in that Giro stage when he didn't get relegated. And then I think he checks under his shoulder a couple of times, and he would have known Krohn was there. And then he has another sharper correction to the left. It forces Krohn. He doesn't brake and he doesn't stop pedaling, but he definitely takes the power off the pedals for a fraction of a second as he has to course correct, go to the left sharply, and then try and go back up the space on the left-hand side. And Costa wins over the line. Benji and I immediately were like, red card, 100% sprint deviation, should be relegated. Krohn is furious straight away. You can see him. It's in the Corvos photo on YouTube shouting at Costa. Costa doesn't look back at him, doesn't even react to say, what are you talking about? Which is, you know, I think that was telling that Costa didn't do that. Secondly, Costa barely celebrated. Thirdly, a Portuguese fan offered him a flag at the finish. He didn't take it. I think Costa knew what was going to come. But, yeah, do you see it as a – remind people what the rule is, Benji, for the umpteenth time.
The moment that you are after launching your sprint, you're not allowed to deviate from your lane and in doing so endangering another rider. Now, this rule has several issues. First of all, a deviation was definitely present here. The second thing, danger, that's an issue because that's subjective. What is dangerous is pushing someone to the side or forcing them to evade. Dangerous, I'd say that it definitely could be seen as dangerous today, and I think that it should be applied. But in some occasions, we have situations where it's not as clear, where the gap between the two riders is a bit more, and then it's an issue. So the danger part of this rule is completely undefined and completely subjective, which means that a rider basically has to choose, I should probably crash right now instead of evading. Otherwise, his deviation is probably not going to get punished. And today, they luckily went on the right side of the coin and actually put in the fact that Costa is getting relegated from this, which is good. But there's been so many other occasions where it has been on the other side of the coin. The Alaphilippe one last week, the deviation there, yeah, let's be real. It was dangerous, in my opinion, because it's a similar situation as today. Matthews had to stop pedaling or he would crash. Kron had to evade or he would crash. And there's two decisions differently. Alaphilippe did not get a relegation. And your boy today, Costa, did get a relegation, which I'm all for. They should both have gotten a relegation. But the problem here is the rule. The rule is not defined enough to actually say that the people who are saying, oh, Costa wasn't really endangering Kron. Well, it's difficult to say. I say it's dangerous, but someone else might interpret danger differently. So that's issue one. The second issue is one that was reminded to us again by La Flamme Rouge on Twitter. It's a prisoner's dilemma. If you deviate, if you're Costa in this situation, if you deviate and you get caught, you're going to be sent to the back of the group, which is third. So you lose. If you don't get caught, you get the victory. But if he doesn't deviate, he gets second. So might as well deviate, right? The rule basically incentivizes riders to go for the deviation because the punishment is nowhere near enough.
The current system, the game theory, sort of rational decision is to deviate. If you're going to lose, if you don't deviate, then you should deviate because, I mean, geez, I'm of the view that if Kron doesn't, isn't angry visibly over the finish line, if I presume Lotto Soudal go, their DS marches straight to the tent of the UCI commissaires and say, hey guys, this is 100% deviation, need you to look at this right now and sort this out. If those two things don't happen, I think there's a pretty good chance that Costa isn't relegated. Yep. We saw, is this worse than the Impi deviation, which literally crashed Stannard the other week at Andalusia? Like, I mean, in terms of the element of danger, Stannard literally got crashed. Like, so the danger element was definitely present, and Impi definitely deviated from his lane. He was definitely sprinting. So it is inconsistent. I'm glad they got it on the right side of it today. Costa knew exactly what he was doing. And, I mean, there's other – again, we never know what – because there's no transparency in the application of the rules. So maybe – like, we'll talk about this – we were going to talk about this, Sagan getting fined for obstructing a rider. He got, there's like two different rules they could fine him or penalize him under. Yep. Like maybe they fined Costa for obstruction. Or
they probably didn't hear.
Probably not.
I don't think so. The problem with obstruction is that if you're going to start taking it too seriously, then a lead out like Merku, who's sprinting in the way of others on purpose a bit slower, is technically obstructing other sprinters.
And then we look at the Belgian tour today, so the stage that Caleb Ewan won. Caleb Ewan goes from the left side of the road all the way to the right side of the road, all the way back to the left side of the road. Why is that okay? And I don't have a good answer for you. The only reason it is okay is because he didn't endanger someone because Ackermann couldn't come out of his wheel. And I guess, so yeah, it doesn't really work. Maybe I think the rule basically should be like, Caleb, you're starting your sprint on the left, sprint in a straight line. That's end of story.
Yeah. And additionally, next to that, like the entire system with the UCI is also a bit botched because they're super intransparent about everything. You've got the situation in Belwaze Belgium Tour today with the steer of Beat Cycling Club. They've got this special steer where you can like support your forearms on the handlebars, for example. And well, according to a document that Thomas de Gendt received, a PowerPoint that he shared on Twitter, that specific steer is literally on the PowerPoint saying that it's not allowed. But today in the race, it is allowed because they checked with the UCI and they said nothing about it. So that's also an inconsistent application. The people that are the officials of races are not consistently knowing every single aspect of the rules, which is an issue because if one UCI official says it's right and the other one says it's wrong, then there's some problem with the fact that one of them is wrong. And that should not be the case. If you're an official in a race like this, you should know the factual rules. And yeah, that's clearly not the case in some occasion. But it's also annoying that they are not allowed to respond on public matters because UCI officials are forced to forward every single critic to the official UCI communications.
Yeah, but manager. I email them asking, and they don't say anything. You know, and I remember I did the one time I did get a response was about the Fuglsang leak last year from Cadiff. I got a sort of the response that all the media got. It was interesting though to see, just finishing off the sprint deviation stuff, La Flamme Rouge put out a poll quickly, and I actually laid Costa on bet. I'm such a degenerate. It's getting bad now that live betting's allowed in Andorra, not in Australia. I laid Costa because the result wasn't finished after the finish, because I was like, they will relegate him. The public said 80% yes, that Costa should be relegated. So I actually don't think – I think most people want sprints to be cleaned up, Benji. I don't think seeing people swing from side to side fills anyone – it doesn't make it any more entertaining to me. I don't think it fills anyone with joy or increases the entertainment. I think I think majority of people – maybe if there's an investor you want to invest in, Benji and I will start up a consultancy business for the UCI. We'll become the UCI VAR. Everyone will get relegated that doesn't ride within a 2-inch sort of
No. You had to stop after relegate. Everyone's going to get relegated.
We'll redraft. We should redraft the rules. They need those rules redrafted. Yeah. But anyway, Tour de Suisse stage 6 is done. Stage 7 tomorrow is the ITT, the second one. There's a bit of controversy about this as well on Twitter last night from Magnus Beckstedt about whether this is safe. It's from Descentes to Sedrun, starting in Descentes to Sedrun, finishing in Andermatt, 23 Ks, and it's literally straight up and down a mountain, but not an out and back. It's down the other side. It's over the Oberaal Pass, 9.5 Ks at 6.5%. The gradients are very regular. The controversy is regarding the descent finish, because it goes through a series of hairpins. I'm not sure how steep it is, but there's also a tunneled hairpin, I believe, which could be a little bit sketch, but they'll be on road bikes. And I think hopefully everyone's okay. I mean, if it's dry, I don't think most of the guys who aren't competing for GC won't be really pushing it too much. Who have you got for it, Benji? Because Dennis won't be on the TT bike. Is it Carapaz who gets the advantage back doing this on road bikes?
I hope to see Dumoulin do well. I just don't know if he is remotely near a form to do well there, but I would love to see it.
Does he do it on the
TT
bike?
Yeah, he's the only rider crazy enough to do it on the TT bike. so fucking funny. But that's one of the names that I would love to do well, but I'm completely unsure about. I don't think that the flat TTers will be up for it. I think that I want to try and say Uran for this one as a bit of an outsider. I feel like an uphill climb, a descent, why not? Rigoberto Uran.
Yeah, to win, you'll have to take a lot of risks or push it very hard on the descent. That's what people were having the issue with. And does Carapaz want to do that with the Tour de France so close? Do you think Alaphilippe will push it, Benji, on the descent?
I think they'll all push it. Carapaz, Alaphilippe, they're going to try and win this race. Like, yeah, it's a race they want to win. I think that I'm curious what Matthews would do on this time trial, because he's good at like shorter time trials.
Nah.
But the climbing section's too hard here, right?
I'll be betting on Jakob Fuglsang to win this stage, depending on when the odds come out.
Really?
I think he'll push the descent pretty hard. And, I mean, I don't know the odds yet. If he's $2, no, obviously I won't. But, like, I still think Carapaz and Alaphilippe are more likely to beat him. But steady climb, not too steep, and then pushing it on the descent, road bikes, Astana been good in the TTs. I know it's not a TT bike, TT, but Powers?
Got 11th on the time trial? Cataneo, perhaps, like he got third on the time trial.
Yeah, I think we're going to see some weird results tomorrow. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to watch an unusual TT like this. So tune in for that. And otherwise, check out our Tour of Slovenia video and tour. Oh, and you can continue on if you're on podcast players now. Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast with Benji Nyssen and the small animal. If you're watching on YouTube, this is the recap of stage 3 of the Tour of Slovenia. a great stage today. I really, really enjoyed the last 25 kilometers of this from Brezice to Crusco, 165 Ks long, and it's all about the Šremić climb. 4.3 Ks at 5.6%. That crests 21 Ks from the finish to short descent, then straight into a 1K punch of 6.8%. Then a descent and then false flat sort of run into town of about 12 or 11 kilometers. So difficult to control. The order of the day would be Bike Exchange trying to drop, I think, you know, trying to set up Stannard and whether really Bauhaus would be dropped on that climb, who is the best sprinter in this race. But we had a breakaway as usual, Benji, including the man I liked for the finish, but he got in the break, Restrepo.
Yeah, it seems like the last few years we've had a bit of a nod type of rider in him, because he had decent Conti sprints, but he seems to go on to the attack a lot more recently. And he was there together with Monaco, not a rider living in Monaco, but he is actually Italian. We've got also Cepeda, but not the invisible Giro man Cepeda. It was Jefferson Alvaro. I don't know if they're related. I'm guessing they are, but I'm not sure about it. So if anyone knows that, drop it below. I'm curious to know. But he was in the break as well for Caja. We had Sergio Araiz and Kenny Molly in the break, but that breakaway wasn't going to do much today. They eventually got caught when Bahrain started pulling in the peloton earlier on, which I found intriguing, because I dare to say that on this stage it would fit them more to be playing defensively.
Maybe Bahrain just accepted that Bauhaus was gonna be in trouble, and I don't know. I thought it was going to be a really messy race after those climbs, because we saw on stage two when Pagacci won yesterday, I expected it to be kind of controlled on that climb. Absolute madness. And he broke away. So it's a bit more loose this race, it seems, than a normal World Tour racing. Yeah. But yeah, when did Restrepo get brought back? Was it on the base of this Šremić climb?
Yeah, it was just before it, and the attackers all got caught at that point. Well, Restrepo was the final one indeed that tried to attack away from the others in the breakaway, and it didn't take long for UAE to try and take control on that climb, and they went to the front, and they started hitting it, but not necessarily with, like, oddest riders pacing at a godlike tempo. They actually tried to attack with Micah in the earlier parts of the climb, and I found it interesting because, like, Micah attacks, and in the group we see that nobody instantly responds, but it takes a good 10 seconds before Trotnik tries to bridge up. What do you do if you're UAE, if, for example, Micah and Trotnik are at the front? Do you just let them go and try and... Yeah, but Trotnik is a better sprinter. Like, what do you expect then? Are you just going to, like, not chase them anymore and hope that it goes? Luckily, Astana was taking over in the peloton and closed it down again. But yeah, I found it an interesting dilemma whether that two-man group would be good for UAE to let go.
I mean, yeah, we already saw Bauhaus dropped. It seemed like Bahrain were like, okay, we've got Mohoric and Trotnik. Let's not sacrifice their two opportunities. They're great attackers, great finishers in this sort of field for Bauhaus, who already was lingering at the back. I mean, Bike Exchange did, as we said yesterday, they hit it from the base. The problem was it was one guy. This is a, what is it, 4.3 Ks. I'm not sure who was on the front. Apologies to him. He did a great job. He absolutely split the field, but there was no follow through. There was no second rider to attack. And I think Kanga there controlling might have helped. But yeah, they got lucky, I think, Bike Exchange, that UAE didn't do what Benji was suggesting, which was, you know, given that Micah's gone up the road with Trotnik, maybe it's a better idea to have someone else counter that or bridge across, because Trotnik's beating Micah head-to-head. Luckily for them, Astana wanted Javier Romo to have a go. I think that's their rider. He attacked. He then got brought back by UAE. I think they allowed Vegard Stekelenburg to come back. So there was lots of attacks flying on this climb, this Šremić climb. I think if Pogačar attacks, he doesn't get brought back. I don't see him getting brought back at the attack, but he didn't today. I think he decided to ride for ULC or Trentin. Trentin eventually caught back up to them. I'm not sure whether it was in the descent off the Šremić climb. It was pretty much all together. Then the last punch, a lot of opportunities here again for UAE to try something. They got Polans, Micah, Vegard Stekelenburg, ULC, Pogačar, Trentin. Six guys, I think. When at a certain point, Trentin obviously wasn't in a condition to attack straight away. He was at the back of the group. But I was like, got Aberastri, Stannard in this group, and Moritz, Ulysses not winning the sprint, like not even close to winning a final sprint against those guys. Micah didn't look strong enough to do anything. And so if you don't attack on that climb and try and send attacks with various riders that you have, you're going to be trying to control and a difficult 11Ks with a large-ish group with riders trying to attack you. What would your play have been there, Benji? Because they did have, you know, narrow roads. There were opportunities for them to lose the wheel and have further riders attack. And I don't think a starter would have been strong enough to bring them back straight away.
Yes, certainly. And I think there's multiple parts to this. Firstly, I found it intelligent that they waited up on Trenton first while Hulgaard was off on his YOLO solo adventure for a bit. And eventually they called back up to Hulgaard the second that Trenton was in the group. That's a small part I wanted to add because I think that's a good strategy that they did. Then a bit later, they seemed to fold completely towards Trenton, like you mentioned. And I would not have really chosen that because we know that Trenton has had properly weak flat sprints in his life. And recently, I can't even remember the day where he did a flat sprint properly, because in the Tour de France, it was always 7th, 8th, 9th in those sprints. And that's just not really the kind of thing you want to have if you want to compete against Aberasturi in a flat sprint, who also is able to get a top 5, top 4 in Vuelta stages as well in a flat sprint. So, yeah, I wouldn't have completely trusted Trentin, and you've got the upper hand numerically, so I would try to play that out. There's one opportunity that I see in this race where I was like, you should not do this. I was shouting at my screen, like, don't do this. And that was when Daniel Kanger decided to try and attack away from the group. And that is a bike exchange riders try to reverse lead out for Stannard. So forcing the other teams to have to close him down, and Stannard could just sit in the wheel of the people that are trying to close down Kanger. But UAE responded to that with one rider. I think it was Micah, but I'm not sure about it, getting to the wheel.
Could have been Pallant.
Was it? Sorry?
Could have been Jan Pallant. It was the small guys.
Very possible. And at that point, the gap was like 10 to 15 meters. And the second UAE rider decides to close it. But at that point, I'm like, you've got a situation where you either sprint against Trenton in the peloton, well, with Trenton against Aberasturi and such in the peloton, which I don't trust. Or you can have the person you've got with Kangert trying out sprint Kangert, a rider that is a time trialist and doesn't exactly have a good sprint at all. I would have put my money on trying to have Kanger do that attack, just sit up in the peloton. Others need to close it. Probably was going to get closed eventually because Kaja still had two team members for Aberasturi there to try and close things down if necessary. But it offers some play, and opportunities like that are opportunities you want to try and use to make sure that the other teams don't have teammates anymore, and the next attack might work again, or the next attack. And you've got so many riders in that group that you could have done so much more than just do a lead out for Matteo Trentin here. That's my case.
Tratnik attacked late, and that weakened the UAE train even more. So Tratnik attacked, and they have Moritz behind, so they reverse lead out for Moritz. But yeah, Pogacar leads out Trentin. Trentin going first through that right-hand bend, kicking with a little bit early, and then Aberastri comes out of from deep. I think he was on Remy Mertz's wheel and kicks around him and beats Trenton easily, and it's actually Moritz getting the draft off Aberastri, comes to his left-hand side, and just comes a little bit late. Aberastri, too quick, second to Bauhaus, nearly beat him on stage one. And I think that was the big indicator of how quick he is right now in a flat sprint. And not, you know, Bauhaus is pretty good at like two pro, this sort of level, and Aberastri, a little bit different, would have been there. So kind of played out as we expected, given that we saw him come over the climb. Here's the top 10. Aberastri, Moritz, Trentin, Mertz, Askov, Pallesen, Shaw, Munoz, Carboni, Strakov, Romo, Hulgaard, 11th. Now, the interesting question, Benji, man, you mentioned and told me to look out for Hulgaard. Could he have won or got third or something in that sprint if he hadn't attacked sort of with 12Ks to go?
I think a top five is definitely possible. I won't say that he would have won this sprint, but I found it intriguing because in stage one, he also went in the breakaway instead of trying to go for the sprint. Perhaps he just doesn't have the confidence in a sprint, which I'd say perhaps try it because he's had some decent sprints in the past. And I was just surprising that he tried to go for that attack, but I think it was a decent opportunity because it was indeed that moment that UAE was subtly trying to wait to get Trentin back at the back again. So perhaps a way to try and counter that, but it's difficult to do that. One name I do want to point out is someone that has been on the back ropes of the groups in the last few days, but is still looking decent in GC. A Slovenian rider in his home country, Christian Hočevar, he is in the white jersey in this race. And he's riding for Adria Mobil, riding really well. I'm very curious what the guy will do in the future because he's still a pretty young man. He is 22 years old and was second in Cours de la Pays, I think, a week or and a half ago or something. So definitely talented and can definitely climb. So just curious, I wanted to throw that name in there.
Yeah, there's a few young guys looking good. James Shaw for Ribble, sixth in this sprint, is actually quite a good result. He was sixth yesterday as well. He was on Lotto Soudal until 2018. He's trying to work his way back into the Pro Tour. He seemed to join World Tour very early. He was a trainee in 2016 when he would have been 19 years old. Maybe he's developing a little bit later. So I feel like he's a guy who maybe in 18 or maybe next year, if you're looking at his power numbers and how he's going at Slovenia, could be a guy to make the jump at least back to Pro Conti level, definitely capable of riding at Pro Conti level. And I think somewhere like YOLO would be a good fit for him as well with races they do. But yeah, an interesting, I really liked the last 20 kilometers, interesting tactics. I think maybe UAE Benji, this is good that they did this in that they won't make this mistake again in sort of World Tour level for Trentin. At the Vuelta, you know, at the Vuelta, if they get into this sort of situation where you see more regularly these reduced groups, like, would you back Trentin to beat Magnus Cort in a sprint head-to-head right now?
No.
So, yeah.
I think that Cort is better. It's a difficult situation because, like, if you're in a group with two riders instead of, like, five, then I would have tried to go for Trentin. But if you've got five people, you might as well try and play around a bit because if you, for example, have Trentin respond to the attack of Trotnik, there's no other team that can bring you back. No other team will bring that back. And I think that those are the kind of opportunities that can be seen, although that specific example is a bit in hindsight, though.
Yeah, I mean, if you see our Discord message receipts, we can't get accused of hindsight 2020. I think, yeah, he's a really good, I think, maybe last kilometer attacker would have been a better option if UAE have multiple riders in a group in the future. But no matter, I mean, they won the stage yesterday, which they might, well, they probably did expect, and Pogacar's leading GC by over a minute. Tomorrow's stage is the big one. It's to Nova Gorica, 163 Ks, and it's all about the Ravnica climb, 2.7 Ks, 11%, straight into the final wall, 2.4 Ks, 13.5%. This might be the toughest finish in pro cycling this year. Let me know if there's any tougher. Apparently there's gradients over 25%. Just really, just brutal. And Pogacar's probably winning this stage. I think over 90% chance of winning this stage. UA will control it.
Who will get second? Come on, let's do this. Who will get second?
That's good, good idea. I mean, I like Stedman because he won GC at Tour of Antalya. He's really small, a good climber, but I'm not sure. Maybe it'll be, who's that lad you mentioned? The young one on Adria?
Hočevar?
Is he a good climber?
He seems to be a good climber, but he does have the opposition of a Sobrero, a Carboni, and so forth, so might be difficult.
I think Jani Brakovic, top three.
Okay.
Put that down. Is Roman? I know Roman Kreuziger's in this race as well.
Takarin as well, and we saw him again at the back of a group in a descent today.
Really? Okay, yeah, well, yes. I mean, yeah, if Zakarin wants a watts per kilo test, then tomorrow, but you need to be in good position after the short descent from the Ravnica climb, so... Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. Kangut maybe could go okay, pure climber. I will see Trutnik, the Zonkland, Zonkland maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to look for like a, I don't recognize a lot of the names. But yeah, Pogacar's the out and out favorite. He should extend his GC gap tomorrow on the Tour of Slovenia. Until then, we'll have the recap afterwards. Ciao.